The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Okay, we're going to start again. I know a couple of people are still filtering back from lunch, but I want to try to keep on schedule more or less 15 minutes. We're okay. So we've got an excellent series of two panels this afternoon with a short break in between. And Ann Bartow is going to be moderating this panel and introducing the speakers for this panel. But I wanted to give a short introduction to Ann before she starts. Ann is a professor of law at the University of South Carolina. She teaches intellectual property law, copyright law, trademark and unfair competition law, cyberspace law, patent law, basically everything IP she teaches. She has done a lot of visiting at various law schools, including the University of Idaho, University of Dayton, Temple, and American University of Washington College of Law. When she was a lawyer before becoming a professor, she specialized in patent litigation. Her scholarship focuses on the intersection between intellectual property laws and public policy concerns with an emphasis on feminist legal theory. And she has published a number of papers that she's given at this conference. She was referred to as one of the founding organizers while she was visiting here of the first conference. I think has been back every year since, has given a paper every year. And we're delighted to have her serve as a moderator and commentator today.
Thank you very much. I'm going to do two things very quick. I'm going to just raise one question. I'm going to just give a very brief introduction to the panelists and let them tell you more about themselves if they want to, if they feel it's relevant and would like to do that, and then shut up and let the program go on. The question that always comes up for me is, why does this seem wacky? Right? We've heard this, like, why isn't it sort of an intuitive thing? We know that every area of the law has sort of gender implications. Why would this be sort of a wacky thing? But I did want to say, probably I would have given up if it weren't for people like Anita Allen. When I published an article in 2001 and the phone rang and it was Anita Allen saying, I just read your article, your fellow traveler really liked it. I guess just for the older people or more senior people, as you were, the importance of mentoring in calls like that, that doesn't mean the world to some of us in South Carolina, maybe feeling a little isolated. And then the other thing, of course, is American. Being able to come back here every year is just quite a lifeline. Everybody in this room has just meant the world to me. So that being said, a question that has come up for me recently, and maybe you too, you might have noticed there's an election going on, a primary, being here in D.C., and one of the things, of course, that's sort of the backstory of what's going on is the fact that Hillary Clinton's a woman and the fact that Barack Obama's not white. And all this stuff about race and gender, you know, and all these kind of screaming headlines saying, you know, gender's an issue in this election. You go, well, wait a second, like, don't men have a gender? Right, like, wasn't gender an issue in every single, I mean, this never gets talked about before. There's always been, you know, every single president has had a gender. Right? I mean, had to pick one out of the binaries. But suddenly, of course, it's the idea of the women that's different and intersecting how we conceive women and gender is, really important generally, and I think it's really important intellectual property. And so what I'm going to do now is just briefly mention the three speakers and then start with Kevin. Kevin Collins is on the faculty at Indiana University School of Law, and he writes about patents, I think, primarily. His paper talks about patent law, and he's also an architect. He's an architect and continues to be an architect, which I think is really neat, in a prior life. Secondly, I have Ian Kerr, who was one of my earliest friends in intellectual property life generally, one of my favorite Canadians, and people generally. He does media studies and philosophy, and as well as being a law professor. And then Laurence Russell, I totally apologize for not speaking French at all, I'm being an ignorant American about that, I'm mispronouncing your name, who is an artist, and I just met her today, and I have kind of her outline, really interested in what she has to say. So with that, I'll give it to Kevin.
Great, thank you. I am not someone who has been here for the last 5 years. This is a new event for me, and I'm enjoying it very much. Thank you for welcoming me into this event. I have to say I'm here in large part because of a little bit of a coincidence. I sat down one evening in a noodle shop last fall with a copy of Donna Haraway's well-known essay, Cyborg Manifesto. I read the piece because I have concerns about a patent law proposal that I was working on, and vague suspicions that I could crystallize those concerns through concepts that Haraway was working on. Lo and behold, I show up in the office the next morning, and there's an email from Vicky about the IP Gender Conference. I took this as a sign, and I agreed to come burden you all with my suspicion and to ask for your help. As I said, suspicion was vague last fall, and in some ways it remains so. Okay, so let me start with a statement that I can't help but feel, given what I've witnessed so far today, that this is kind of a mea culpa. My patent law proposal openly embraces a dualist approach to legal doctrine. Put that on the table front and center. In particular, it embraces what I'm going to call a dualism of mind and world. Sensitivity to feminist critique often means having a skeptical view of such dualist thinking, and as Dan Burke, sitting stage right, has suggested, that this also carries over into IP, I think, quite firmly. So, informally, this talk can be thought of as kind of a look over my shoulder that could be subtitled, what's the unintended repercussion of my advocating a doctrine based on a dualist distinction between mind and world in my hard-nosed lawyerly advocacy for patent reform? To lay out what I see over my shoulder when I look, I'm going to briefly talk about three things today. I'm going to put on the table my proposal in reductive form. I'm going to draw two themes out of Harlitt's Cyborg manifesto, I think neither of which is very shocking. And then I'm going to use those themes to raise two challenges that I have, that I see the essay as mounting to my own proposal and suggest to some degree how I might react. So here I am talking about my own work, critiquing my own work. It's a kind of odd collapse of subject and object, but I hope you'll indulge me here. So my patent proposal, first off, is really quite straightforward. I think it's even easier to talk about outside of the context of patent doctrine than it is to talk about inside the context of patent doctrine. It's a proposal that seeks to increase the space of the public domain, however we think about that metaphor. More specifically, I argue that thought performed by the human mind is different in a way that should matter. It should be different. Actions that can be performed through human cognition should be categorically unpatentable, while I'm not going to make that same statement about a lot of steps or methods which I'll describe as extroverted steps or extramental steps, right? Things that don't necessarily occur entirely within the human mind. I'll refer to this proposal as a bar on the propertization of thought from time to time, right? My own little thing. Just as an example, to give you an idea of how this operates, let me briefly recount the Supreme Court case that wasn't a Supreme Court case in 2006 in Laboratory Corp versus Metabolite Labs. In that case, there was a claim that came before the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court was curious whether this was a kind of claim that could receive patent protection. Researchers had discovered something new about human blood. They realized that there was this inverse correlation between two different chemicals. People who had an elevated level of one chemical, homocysteine, tended to have a deficiency of another chemical, a B vitamin, whereas people who had a kind of normal level of homocysteine tended to have a normal level of B vitamin, right? So it's a statistical correlation. Based on this discovery, the researchers filed the following two-step method claim, right? Seeking to exclude others from being able to perform these two steps. First, testing for homocysteine. And this step was broad enough that it could be used, it would cover any method of testing for homocysteine, whether it's part of the prior art or not, right? So this is not the inventive portion of the method. The second step was correlating, I am reducing here, but correlating an elevated level of homocysteine to a B vitamin deficiency, right? So it's a method of detecting a B vitamin deficiency by measuring homocysteine and mentally correlating the results that you read to the status of someone's B vitamin level. The arguments that were before the Supreme Court about why this should be patentable or should not took a lot of different forms, but I basically launched into a little tirade saying, look, it's thought that's at issue here. It's not issues of intangibility or laws of nature or anything else. I came up with, for reasons I'm unfortunately not going to be able to go into, decided on a proposal that suggested, look, acts of human cognition. If you're just thinking about the information that's revealed in a patent specification, well, that should be unpatentable subject matter, right? Human thought is one area where patent law should not go. To put this dualist nature of my proposal in sharpest contrast, consider a hypothetical, narrower variant of the laboratory corp claim. Consider a claim in which the corresponding step is limited to, say, correlating using software, right, a computer, or as I suggest in the paper, correlating using a game board spinner, right? There are a lot of different, very simple mechanisms through which you can perform this correlation step, which might not be mandatory. Under my proposal, for reasons, again, I unfortunately can't get into here, I suggest that it's a good reason that this, nonetheless, it's a good proposal to draw a distinct line between what is mind and what is world, to say that methods that read on acts of human cognition should be unpatentable, but methods that read on extroverted steps, non-mental kinds of information processing, might well be patentable. Of course, in doing this, I have to characterize myself as a kind of unreformed old world thinker, right? I'm embracing, even not an ontological distinction between mind and body, not going to get into whether or not, as a matter of fact, actually mental processes are non-physical. What concerns me is a functional distinction between mind and world, something where I can say there's a reason why we might choose to treat mind categorically different from the way in which we do world. Part of this has to do with the belief that we end up with a more finely, better-tempered patent regime. Part of it ends up with a suggestion that this is actually a proposal that the courts might adopt, right? Because in trying to advocate for reform, I know the courts are interested in rules that they think they can apply, and what kinds of rules end up being rules the courts think they can apply? Well, they end up having a lot to do with these dualist distinctions. So here I am. Here I am presenting at a conference, and I'm openly embracing. I'm filing a brief today before the Federal Circuit suggesting precisely this distinction. Okay, so now, two sideboard themes from Donna Haraway's essay. Given the limits on both my time and my competence, I can't do justice to a true summary of what Haraway's sideboard manifesto is about. I'm not even going to try. Instead, I'm going to be a blatant appropriator here. I'm interpreting Haraway's work so as to explain two seeds around which my concerns about my proposal on the propertization of thought have crystallized. Theme one. In a factual sense, Haraway suggests that we are cyborgs. Now, cyborgs, of course, are combinations of machine and organism. Haraway is too much of a committed postmodernist to say in some objective, real sense we are cyborgs rather than some other way. It's a kind of metaphorical description, but I'm going to reduce her argument here, for way of convenience, to say that this is a kind of factual, technological sense in which we are actually cyborgs. Haraway comes to feminism from a background as a scientist and a historian of science, so one of the jolt that she's seeking to give to feminism when she writes her essay, as I understand it, is that the introduction of technology is a topic that should be embraced rather than rejected by feminism. Haraway does this in part by arguing that during the late 20th century, the boundaries of our skin no longer capture the phenomena that are constitutive of who we are. We are cyborgs in both introverted and extroverted encounters with the machine. We have much of the machine within each of us. Many of the things we do are very machinic. And furthermore, our capacities, our capabilities are highly contingent on the technological environment in which we find ourselves. So we are cyborgs, we're machine-human hybrids in the sense that both we are becoming more machinic in certain ways, and who we are is becoming very dependent on the technological networks in which we find ourselves. Okay, so that's one theme from Haraway's Cyborg Manifesto, which raises a distinct, although very pragmatic, a challenge to my proposal, which is that I might just be missing the boat here. To the extent that our minds are cyborg minds, establishing a boundary for property rights at the limit of what the unassisted human mind can do is clearly an imperfect strategy, right? If we function as cyborgs in both introverted and extroverted senses, then in an ideal world, some extra mental conduct and processes should probably be beyond the scope of patent law as well, and perhaps some kinds of cognitive thought could be encompassed by patent law to the extent that we view it as in very machine. Right? So it's possible. If you take the cyborg as a technological zeitgeist, right, at the time that we're in, and we say we function as cyborgs, then my strict dualism of what the unassisted human mind can do versus what technology out there in the world can do, saying one is unpatentable, the other is patentable, is not the perfect line to be drawn. Okay, so what do I do about this challenge? Well, this is actually a challenge that can very easily be accommodated into classic legal reasoning just by saying that, look, what I'm doing is putting forward a proposal that's a proxy, right? It's a proxy that's in some ways under-inclusive, over-inclusive with respect to the normative justifications of that particular rule. And to the extent I agree that we are cyborgs and this in some degree undermines my proposal, I can nonetheless say, look, it's an imperfection that we have to live with in order to be able to come up with a rule that I think a court might actually adopt. Okay, so that's one challenge to my proposal that I've come to from Donna Haraway's essay. A second theme is a broader concept that's not really about technology per se. Haraway also uses the cyborg as this kind of mythic figure, right? A stand-in for the value of a feminist thought and action in a world that's beyond dualisms, right? The cyborg is a stand-in as this mythic figure, a rallying cry for action where we're no longer thinking in dualist terms. And here, it's actually the dualist constructual structure itself, which is in some way problematic, as been suggested in a number of the early presentations, and as Haraway herself mentions, certain dualisms have been persistent in Western traditions and have all been systematic to the logics and practices of domination. Of all those who have been constituted as others, including women and people. Dualisms, of course, also not only affect these kind of disparate treatments, but they also naturalize that disparate treatment under the logic of presenting the distinctions of fact, right? That's one of the problems that we have about these duals. So cyborg politics, in Haraway's view, are politics of affinity rather than politics of identity, a way to move forward. Okay, so now if that's the second cyborg theme that I'm going to extrapolate from Haraway's essay, poses a distinct challenge for what my proposal is able to do. Under the banner of the cyborg, Haraway suggests that dualist thinking is intrinsically harmful, in some way tied up with domination and subordination. I can't get around this kind of objection by saying, oh, my proposal is just an administrable proxy. In fact, it's precisely the search for such a proxy that the court might perceive as administrable that is responsible for leading to the dualist approach. Thus, the question I find myself asking is the following. In my efforts to withdraw property rights from spheres in which I don't think they really belong, to increase the public domain, am I actually doing more harm than good in proposing this dualist doctrine? If my proposal entrenches a conceptual dualism of mind in the world further into patent law, what are the kind of harms that come from this that I have to counterbalance against the benefits that I see from instituting this proposal? Well, my response to this challenge, and this is where the suspicion becomes quite vague, is to suggest, try to delve a little bit deeper and figure out why exactly dualist legal doctrines cause such problems under a feminist analysis. And here I have to say I'm not going to be able to get into it at length because of time constraints, but Dan's essay from a previous generation of this seminar was quite useful. But let me suggest that there are two distinct impacts that I think dualist doctrines in law might create. Right? One of these kinds of impacts, one reason to avoid dualist doctrine, is what I would call a regulatory impact of dualist doctrine. This is the distinctions or inequitable treatments traditionally subordinated groups, well, with law acting in its sense of capital L, right? It's a regulatory regime where it's doling out differential rights to different bunches of people. So for instance, Dan mentions in his copyright, in his discussion of problems of dualism in intellectual property, that there's a mind-body dualism in the context of the doctrine that patent law uses to assign priority to invention. And this particular dualism might well inequitably sort out rights to who gets to own the patent between those people who are involved in a work of the mind versus the kind of manual labor in order to execute this. And Dan relates that in a very interesting way, I think, to kind of invisible labor concerns that many feminists have had, and suggests, okay, here's an instance in which the regulatory impact of this dualism is creating different rights, giving them to different sets of people. Right? This is similar to the concerns we were talking about, where maybe intellectual property laws are taking away the rights from traditionally suppressed groups just at the moment when they might be able to claim intellectual property. Right? So it's actually disparately allocating rights in society. Looking at this kind of impact of a dualist doctrine, I haven't been able to figure out, and I put myself here for your suggestion, but I haven't been able to figure out how my proposal actually disparately distributes rights in a way that would reinforce existing inequalities. I can't understand how having patent law not reward the proprietization of thought, disparately impacts any particular group except maybe those people who are likely to file for business method patents, and I can't quite fit them into a traditionally a group that has been historically repressed under these dualisms in the past, therefore I'm not sure whether to be concerned about it. Okay, so that's one kind of regular impact of a dualist doctrine that I can't find in my proposal. Of course, my proposal would have a different kind of impact, which is what I call a rhetorical impact of the dualist doctrine. This is kind of the dark underbelly of law's expressive function, right? Here, the potential harm of dualist thinking lies not in the difference in the set of rights allocated amongst groups, but rather in the reinforcement of a conceptual structure long associated with power or domination. Again, to pull an example from Dan's article, Dan talks quite eloquently about how copyright establishes a dichotomy, a dualism between fact and expression, how a lot of power regimes depend on the notion that there are objective facts out there, right? The power regime sits more stably if they're sitting on something which isn't a cultural construction, but is a natural construction, that isn't an artifact of nature. So therefore, in a certain way, the copyright regime, the distinction between fact and expression, reinforces certain power structures that exist in society, right? But it's not actually the allocation of the set of rights that come out of that. It's not the fact that there's no one, map makers don't have copyrights, actually, in fact, they do, as Dan points out, because you can have compilation rights. The allocation of rights isn't necessarily the harm here, but it's the extent to which the rhetoric of the doctrine actually reinforces the power, existing power. And here, I openly acknowledge that my mind world dualism has this kind of rhetorical impact upon which Haraway might frown. Centrality of reason, of human cognition, are concepts that have been historically wound up in relegating the feminine and other, among other concepts, the status of the disparaged other. Okay, but then to conclude, I ask, okay, so what do I do, right? I have a proposal, a dualist proposal, that I think actually effectuates a legal shift, which I believe is for the better. In terms of the rights that it allocates, yet, in some way, it is tied up with these very dualist conceptual structures which many people are advocating we should try to leave behind. So there's the quandary for the person who is currently filing a brief before the Federal Circuit trying to effect change in order to increase the public domain, yet interested in what a feminist or gender-sensitive approach might make up. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kevin. You did something that you're not supposed to do, which is you drew me into your article. Now I'm not focused. And
I also ran over. I thought you were giving me trouble for that.
No. I would never do that. I want to first sort of thank everybody here at the Washington College of Law, in particular Vicki and Angie and Steve, for all of the organizational excellence, and also to say that I'm a proud partner, I guess I could say, of this institution. My university, which is the University of Ottawa, has a number of exchange programs as well as joint degree programs that we're working on together. And so it's great to be here as part of this seminar. I am going to, first of all, tell you a little bit about what motivated me to do this talk, which sort of takes me beyond the bounds of my own expertise. And that is a conference that I attended in 2005 that was called Wither the Middleman. Now, this conference was not a conference about gender, not surprisingly, perhaps. There were three things that were poignant about this conference to me. The first is that it was where I met Christine, who is now my friend and colleague and someone I very much look forward to seeing whenever I can. It was also the place where I developed what you'll see as my schizophrenic style of PowerPoint, wherein I was doing a parody on Larry Lessig, who unfortunately left early and didn't get to see it. But most importantly, I guess, for the purposes of this talk, is it was also a place where I got to hear Anne Bartow speak, who I had known for a long time, and she had heard her speak many times. But it was a truly inspirational moment for me in that talk. She was talking about gender discrimination, which she often does. And she started with a personal... that wasn't meant to be funny. was true. Funny and true. Okay. She was talking actually very. I felt it was a very powerful thing she was telling us, a personal anecdote about some of the kind of treatment she had received as a young colleague at her law faculty, and in particular about someone she didn't call, but I'll call the boy next door, who, in essence, I think, if you don't mind me saying so, you've said it before publicly, basically greeted her when she came to her office and said, "Now, why would we hire a woman to do IP?" And she told us a story which was really telling about how over time, being her colleague, not surprisingly, she, and this is her language, she flipped him. He came around to sort of see exactly what kind of value she had to offer. And she raised a challenge to the rest of us at this conference, in particular the men at this conference on the middlemen. And I recall a particular amount of high testosterone on our panel that Anne and I were both on. And she said, "Why don't you just take on a gender issue in the work that you're currently doing? Why don't you just try that?" And so she flipped him, and she flipped me, and then when I got back to Canada, I instantly started thinking about how I wanted to meet that challenge. And a couple years later, I tried to flip it forward. In other words, what I did was I took the challenge that I had started working on, and when I finally got around to making my first public presentation on it, I told all the people on the cyber list about it and put the challenge there. I only had one other male person respond back to me to say that they were going to try and do it too. I don't know if Anne heard anything more about that. But that was sort of the impetus of this work, and it's part of a larger project that I'm part of, which is called On the Identity Trail, which, as its title would suggest, sort of is more focused on issues of privacy, anonymity, and identity. And I want to sort of say one more sort of preliminary thing here, which is this work is also influenced by a very important figure in our project, a woman who we'll call Jane Doe. I would like to call her by another name, but my legal system actually prevents me from doing so. There's a publication ban on doing so. Jane Doe, who works with us both as an activist and as a scholar and a writer, was somebody who was raped several years ago in the city of Toronto by somebody called the Balcony Rapist. After that trial, and going through the whole legal experience, there were many things which impacted her. She wrote an amazing book, which you should all read, which is called The Story of Jane Doe. And I'd be more than happy to send you a copy. I've got a box full of them. In working with her and learning from her, we learned not only about the kind of gender discrimination that takes place throughout the whole criminal procedure in what she became embroiled in, but she subsequently took on the Toronto police and she sued them in tort law. And she sued them because, in particular, they knew a lot of details about this particular rapist, and they knew the kinds, a very narrow area where they could highly predict that person was going to be targeting things, and they did nothing about it. And so as a result of her subsequent litigation, in Canada, the police now have a duty to warn in these kinds of situations. And so I highly admire her work, and one day we were talking, and she told me about this government program, which is actually the basis of what I want to talk to you about. Just a quick shout-out to some people on my team. Sia is in the house here today, but these are a number of people that have been working with me on this issue for the couple of years that I've been doing so, and have added tremendous value to that, so I just wanted to sort of acknowledge them. So I'm talking, my title would suggest I'm talking about ID theft, which I guess isn't properly within the bounds of intellectual property, but if we think of those contexts as expanding and taking a broader interpretation of that, I think that's what I'm going to talk about. And I guess you could say there's three kinds of intellectual property, or sorry, of identity theft that I want to talk about. I'll mention the first two and concentrate on the third. The first one, I think, is pretty trivial. It's the kind of use that most people use on a regular basis when they basically mean that by virtue of some transaction of personal information, credit card fraud took place. You know, so somebody got some identifier and there was credit card fraud. So that's the first kind. That's not the kind that I'm interested in. That kind, for the purposes of our talk today, that kind focuses primarily on financial institutions and the kinds of ways that we can cut this down and the kinds of remedies that are available. ID theft of the second kind requires a bit more imagination, not that much more these days because we've seen it so often. Now we imagine that same kind of situation as in the first case, but instead of just being able to purchase up a bunch of things, it goes on and on in a way that really has a significant impact on the people who are on the other side of the identity theft. Perhaps the perpetrator starts mailing them as gifts the things that were sent to them, which I heard a law professor tell me about at a conference last week actually happened to them. Perhaps the perpetrator also infiltrates their email system, sends things around to other people, causes danger to their reputation. That would be what I would call ID theft of the second kind. We see it all the time in the media now. And it raises questions about how the law should respond to situations where the perpetrator now not only does harms to the institutions, but also to the persons whose identifiers have been misappropriated. So it contemplates not merely financial harms, but additionally harms to the individual who is usually seen to be required to exert all sorts of additional time, money, energy, nerves, esteem, moral worry, to name a few things, during the sweat and tears of restoring their identity credentials. And so in the US and Canada, where I come from, in both places, there are a number of proposals on the table about how to think about ID theft as a kind of appropriation of personhood in a kind of sense. And we're not that far along in terms of really solving those things, but that's not, strictly speaking, what I want to speak about anyways. I want to ask you to imagine a third kind of identity theft. This one perhaps requires greater imagination than the second or first kind, but sadly, at least for some people, I would say perhaps it doesn't. Here's what I want you to imagine. What would happen if the transgressions of ID theft of the second kind became institutionalized? In other words, what would happen if they were systemic? Instead of merely individual bits of personal information traded here and there, what if your entire credentials or identity was not, strictly speaking, stolen from you, but rather strong-armed away from you as part of a single and permanent transaction? What if some powerful entity made you an offer that you couldn't refuse? What if the only way to ensure your informational security, indeed your security of the person and personal safety, required you to forfeit your identity and all of your corresponding credentials? Now, this may seem to you like a sort of bizarre question, either dreamed up by a dystopic young professor, which Gary Marx likes to call me, or an academic thought experiment. But these are very real questions, giving rise to a moral dilemma which a number of members of one of Canada's most vulnerable groups are regularly forced to confront. During the past 15 years, perhaps hundreds of women, I'm not sure exactly how many, have found themselves facing what might be euphemistically called a coercively attractive offer from the government of Canada and its provincial counterparts. Fleeing extreme and relentless violence and a life of unending fear for themselves and, in many cases, their children, they find themselves in a situation of what the government calls last resort. Faced with a truly Faustian bargain, they have to decide whether to continue down a seemingly hopeless, forlorn path of continuing cycles of brutality and imminent death, or instead to give up entirely who they are, their names, their vocations, their credentials, their homes, their hometowns, their families, their friends, their loved ones, their projects, all of their commitments, with the hope that a new and somewhat flimsy set of government identifiers will provide them with enough informational privacy to shield them from those who would hurt or kill them so that they can begin their lives again. They must, in other words, choose whether or not to enter a program, which in Canada is called New Identities for Victims of Abuse, or as some people call it, NEVA. So this is the project that I embarked on, and Human Resources and Development Canada has been the government entity that started this ad hoc program, which is now run by a separate branch that's called Services Canada. So the Canadian government views this as a service that it's offering to women in these situations. And it's something that I've sort of been thinking about in terms of my own research on this Identity Trail project. And what's interesting to me, and one of the things that I want to think about very carefully, is this new identities for victims of abuse. Really, if you think about it, is more about new identifiers for victims of abuse. It's not like the government's handing out new identities, whatever that might mean. They're giving people a set of identifiers. And so part of what I'm interested in is I'm interested in this relationship between identifiers and identity, knowing that with respect to both of these things, sometimes these are things that we assume for ourselves. Sometimes these things are things that are imposed upon us. And it's an interesting question as to whether or not, in this case, women who find themselves in that position are coming to this assuming the new set of identifiers or having them imposed upon them, or whether that duality, to pick up on where you were at, isn't really an appropriate duality to think about it. This is a document given to me by one of the women who was formerly in the program, coming from the province of Alberta. She told me that in her view, she was booted from the program on the basis of certain kinds of needs that she had and was pushing for that they weren't able to fulfill. This document presents it as though she has withdrawn from the program. And what I want to point your attention to, and I know you can't really read it all perfectly well, but the second clause in those paragraphs informs her that she's no longer in the program effective immediately, and as a result, any further use of the aliases which were assigned to her will be considered to be a fraud. So now she's in a position where her identity has been completely misappropriated from her, but if she actually tries to use the pseudonym which the program offered her in flimsy support, she'll be committing a kind of identity fraud. And, you know, sort of to add insult to serious injury, and you look at the letterhead there with the cute little drawing of the small child with the flower at the top, I can only imagine what she might have felt like when she got that letter. So this really paints a picture, and I won't have a lot of time to get into the details. What I will have time to do is quickly explore the question that I want to pose to this group. But let me just say something about the bigger project. So this project has been going on for a couple of years, mostly because this is a secret program. So you can imagine it's very hard to get details about it. Me and my team has been spending a lot of time doing what we in Canada call ATIP, what you call FOIA, and trying to find out as much information about this program as we can. We've also been working hard on this thing that was called Bill 286, which I'm pretty happy to say is something we were able to quash. In essence, what it was going to do was take this program and subsume it under the Witness Protection Act. Which I think if you thought about that for even a moment, would be horrific to think that the way you would deal with this would be to subsume this under a budget which is meant to sort of provide certain kinds of protection for people who are criminals who are turning evidence. My own research on this has been mostly, as I've mentioned, focused on aspects of identity. I'm interested in the social constructions of identity, drawing on everybody from Goffman to Butler. I've also been interested in the gender identity piece here, in respect to the sort of discourse that's been going on around whether we think of people in these situations as victims or survivors and what that impact might have on their own personal identities. And part of what I've been doing before coming into the question that I'm going to ask today is thinking of this philosophical project, and this little graph gives you a bit of a heuristic, but without getting into it, using sort of personal identity theory in philosophy to sort of think about this person who, so you can see this person at three states of their life, at P then P prime and P double prime, and at some point between P prime and double prime, they come into the NEVA program, and asking the question, what is the impact or changes upon their personhood as a way of trying to articulate some of the harms that are going on with all of this. Well, in terms of the question that I want to just pose today, I want to think about NEVA as a kind of identity theft. Does that language even help us in dealing with this problem? And reciprocally, in thinking about it through the lens of this problem, does that help us think about the concepts of identity theft? And I'll skip this stuff about the ATIP. And I won't go into too much detail about the NEVA program because of time, but let me articulate what I see as the two central sets of serious problems that I saw in all of the ATIP work that I did. The first was with respect to access. So, for example, to get into the NEVA program, you have to be able to, for example, if you have kids, show that you have sole custody. You have to have no debt. And so you can start to imagine the list of kinds of things which are the barriers to getting into the program, and then ask who actually has access to the program. if it was a program that was worth having access to. The second set is of things that I've been really focused on is the obligations, the way I would say it to my contract students, the quid pro quo for the program. And there are serious and significant obligations on the part of the women who are thinking about entering this program, including the obligation to sever all ties with your past, including your family, your friends, everything. And so I'll say a little bit more about that in the context of raising this question. Is NEVA a kind of identity theft? Well, I talked about identity theft of the second kind, the sort of more serious kind where we start to see harms to persons when their identifiers are misappropriated. And I would suggest that there is a relationship between these two kinds. In the NEVA example, it's just pushed to the absolute extreme end of the continuum. So with that in mind, we might ask the question, is there a misappropriation of personality? And I don't necessarily mean that in the narrow sense that IP uses that term most often, or even in property law. Because if you sort of think about it that way, you'd probably say, well, not quite. Usually when we think about misappropriations, we think about a taking and a using, and that's not really what's going on here. But I think if you think about the notion of misappropriation and the extent to which it relies on a taking, you can see that really the harm that comes there isn't in the taking. It's in the precluding, right? I think property law folks would talk about this as, you know, if property is about some ability to exclude others, what's going on in this kind of situation when a woman is forced to give up all her identifiers is she's precluded from access to anything that comes with those identifiers in a kind of way. So we can ask, precluded of what? Maybe to access to a person? We have to think really carefully now about what we mean about personality rights. I'm remembering Anita's picture of Bette Midler from the beginning of the day today, talking about voice as one aspect of person. I want to suggest that in the information age, the kind of identifiers that I'm talking about are at least, if not more significant than things like voice and the other things that IP law has recognized. So what I'm talking about here is access to one's personal identifiers. And I was just sort of sketching out a list of the kinds of things that come with loss to that kind of access. One of them is a loss to associational interests. And I told you already that people in this program have to sever ties with their family and friends. But imagine in this network age if you no longer had a social network. If all of a sudden, just one day, that just disappears. And what that will do, not just to your life in terms of your projects and commitments, but even on a sort of the level that IP usually thinks about it, to your economic situation, your economic ability. And that's sort of highlighted further by the idea of having the loss of your credentials. So you go into the NEVA program, let's say you were a nurse or a doctor going into the program, or maybe something else, you had a certain kind of skill set or training. Those things are gone. Now, the NEVA program is trying to figure out a way to have those credentials move through to the new identity. Those are challenges that they're now facing. But even if that were possible, I'm trying to imagine a person in this situation trying to make sense of how they talk about their professional life post-NEVA and what that would mean. All sorts of permissions that we have in societies, and I'm not just talking about your passwords, but memberships to all sorts of projects that we're involved with in life, and also a series of entitlements that just go by the wayside. And then reputational interests, things like your trustworthiness, or to think about it in a non-business sense, your goodwill. And I know, just having moved from one university to another, and at lunch a bunch of us were talking about this idea, a couple people at the table were shifting universities, how much goodwill you lose just moving from one institution where you're known to another, and trying to project what that might be with your entire life, and not having any of the resources or privileges that the people around the table were talking about when we talked about this kind of thing. So I would suggest here that we could start to think about the losses in a property context. Certainly as intangible forms of property, if not intellectual property proper. And, you know, I sort of was digging up some of those classic chestnuts that one might encounter in first-year law. This is an old English case that one might have encountered in Canada, talking about property and recognizing, I think, the sort of central theme that you learn when you take property for the first time, that it's not about things, right? It's about relationships. And the kinds of things that this court recognized is all of those things that go with a person's name, their reputation, their goodwill, as the most valuable aspect of their lives. Certainly having a kind of harm to their economic interests, obviously also to their dignitary interests, but that's not necessarily something I can focus on now. And so I thought about this and just started thinking about this in terms of the kinds of remedies that are available. And I'm not going to go through them, I'll just flash them around. The main point I want to make is this. If we're going to get to a point where we can find, sorry, that pie in the middle used to be an arrow. It's meant to be a conditional between the black and the orange there. But my claim is this. If we're in a situation as we now are, where we're starting to define what kind of remedies will be available for what I call identity theft of the second kind, certainly there ought to be remedies for this extreme situation, what I'm calling identity theft of the third kind. And I'm not going to go through the proposals, so just name them. There's criminal law, there's restitution and victim compensation schemes in Canada. We also, obviously, restitution within private law. Question about whether there should be a general cause of action for these kinds of misappropriations with respect to identifiers, insurance schemes. I just want to end, and I know I'm a bit over time, so I'm just going to end really quickly with I guess what I could call my Socratic proposal. I'm thinking back to Apologia, the trial of Socrates, at the end when he's been convicted of believing in different gods from the states and corrupting the youth of Athens, I think it was. And they've had a vote, he's clearly convicted, but they, as the procedure at that time allowed him to make a proposal of his own what the proper punishment should be. And Socrates' proposal was that he should become a guest at the Prytaneum, which was in the Greek age basically a very, I guess you could call it in modern days, a fancy hotel, but it was a place where the heroes of Athens, in that case it was the Olympians, the athletes, would be put out to celebrate what they've done. I would suggest that in a situation like this, if a government is willing to acknowledge that these situations, because of the failures of its criminal justice system and social justice writ large, are to such an extent that this is the last resort that they're offering, that there ought to be some public mechanism for dealing with and properly compensating people for the kind of identity theft that I'm calling identity theft of the third kind. I'm sorry for taking too long. Thanks very much.
Free license is based on author rights. So we have to assume the position and the location of the author, but I would like to suggest that author is a performative term, as it's already suggested here, I think. So just to say again who I am, so there is no misunderstanding. It's true, I've been trained as a painter, but from 10 years now, I'm acting as artistic director of Constant, a non-profit organization that's based in Brussels. And this organization is linking the theoretical thinking with critical use, artistic behavior, and political questions on the web, and is involved in organizing workshops, lectures, and exhibitions, database in public spaces. What we can name public spaces, I mean, we try to guarantee free, as in free lunch as we have here. So the two public spaces. And the main issues we are dealing with are open source. Open source is not the same as free software. We won't enter this detail, it's not the place here. Cyber feminist, question of copyright, of course, and above all, sharing new media, knowledge, and practice. So I try to be as quick as possible. But again, to be back to who am I? I won't tell you the story of my coming out as a feminist. I mean, each of us, and Jan did it, mentioning his link to art. But every one of us can tell about it and makes you your own trajectory, your own path into feminist. But this is how I moved from being a solitary painter in a studio to working in a collective, even if I look like lonely in my office then. So I moved. So for me, feminism, I will tell you two things about my coming out as a feminist. So for me, feminism revealed, among other things, of course, the relationship that plays between the conditions of work and the conditions of visibility and recognition. So my attention and my questions and my work moved away from painting and the issues about painting and from fine art and went to the framework of the conditions of work, and I followed this path. So to ask myself, how and where the other artists work? Where does the money come from? How do the institution galleries work? Who is the audience? Who is the public? Who is choosing the work to be viewed and displayed? Who is commented? How? And so forth. So feminism helped me also that to realize, and Sylvain is a big part of this, that to be an artist is to be an author in the legal term, but also in the history. And to be an artist or to be an author is not especially welcome land for women. But to be an author can be a living debt. In, like Sabine mentioned already, in 1968, the author died. I hope you know that. So it was Anfried Berg in a book that was published in France on 20 years of theoretical, feminist theory on cinema, published this irony that the moment that the author died, it was the moment that feminists put the energy to make visible the body of the artist and the author, the sex, the gender, the race, body behind the author. So there was this paradox between the author died, ladies, you don't want to be, at the same time it's a good for feminists because the great man was dying, and you can take our position as readers, as activists and re-workers, but at the same time women and families were actively working to make visible these bodies. So again, they won for a moment because somehow most people won't know that the author died at one point. But again, they were claiming that what was good in cultural studies or philosophy was not good, was not exactly what the feminists wanted to do. So again, they exclude them from what was serious. Like someone said, do I have to take this seriously? And so, and Friedberg finished saying, sometimes culture plays us these kinds of tricks. So to go on with the image of the living dead, and don't mistake me, in other lectures I use vampires, witches, and zombies as friends and as a possible embodiment. But I would like to refer as, because the moment I write this text, the moment I publish images, I'm an author. I have to drink to say this. in Belgium law, it is unalienable. In unalienable, you have alien, right? You have to alienation. So I took this. I took this image. This is Alien 4. I'm a science fiction fan also. And this image that Ripley is part alien and alien is part Ripley, as you might know. You might know somehow it's finished. So my idea about alien and working with, I mean, being a living dead, actually taking the position of the living dead, make me, could be also being a cyborg and so on, I have multiple identities, as you might not see it immediately, but make me possible in first, this is to think about what is to be an author, because as Severin mentioned, and everyone, it's not natural, it's a construct. So, and also one thing, when I was writing, and sorry I just toyed with you, is that you're not becoming an author. You are an author. The moment I publish the text, your Google text you have is full of mistakes, there's no becoming, no devenir author. You are. So, I have to do something with that, right? I cannot let it. So I took this image from the 72 from the Air Gallery, and you can recognize some of you, Anna Mendieta and Nancy Sperro, for example. 72 was the moment, again, when you did the author was dying. The women were taking and making visible the female body inside art scene. And so that was cooperative of women building their own system of exhibiting. Again, it was not being an author, but being inside the visual art, visual, visible, and empowering other women. So my suggestion here is, of course, that we, as it was mentioned, women and all people define it as a conceptual and other, we have to fight to enter the authorship, to be recognized as author, to prove our value. So we have to work and walk with the zombie and walk with the alien inside us. So I wanted, you said that why should I want to question my position as an author, and I would like to add something in it is the importance of lineage, genealogy, commitment, history. And of course, to be an author, like it was mentioned, we not always had the right to vote, to enter our own business, or to go to art school, or to science, or even to have a soul for that matter. So we have to be conscious of that history, but as part of the feminist history, I want to take responsibility for transmitting our experience, transmitting knowledge. So as cyber feminist, but I've understood, I also forgot to apologize for my ignorance of your works. So this morning when I asked Anita about, of course she said I work on it, sorry for this. So I know that cyber feminists you're all familiar with. So in my cyber feminist practice, I use the term cyber feminist to inscribe it in between the past, the future, and to talk about the present. So making this link, often I can allow you to make that link. I will explain how and how we practice it. But so I wanted just to show you a few examples, because this is the cyber feminist event we did in 2000. So it was to change practices on new media, but from a feminist point of view, so to construct the image, the music, the website of women, so using technology but from a feminist point of view. And it was just after an event we did on the alternative to copyright before Leslie making these things. So for us, of course, questioning the author was also to question, it's 5 minutes already, my God, I have to speed up. It was also to question our relationship to technology of everything. So let's do enter immediately in the mentor. What I wanted to say in 5 minutes, that for us, free license and free license of software is a way to perform the author right, and it is a way to describe genealogy in our work. So it's not about being outside, as Stephen explained it perfectly, and I'm now confused. It's not to be outside the system, but from the within, how can you question it? And for us, Frida Larsens, or Frida Essence, as you can see, was one of the way to inscribe genealogy, because in the terms of use, you have inscribed the right to copy, to spread, and to transform the creative works. What we have also to mention in the Frida Essence work is that it's not only about copy use, but it's also about the genealogy. So it's not viral. Again, as I mentioned, it's a clear, voluntary work decision to put your work on the free license. So it's not like it's a virus that you can catch, you don't know. No, it's a clear decision. But this decision brings a lot of effects about questioning your relationship to the institution you're working with, questioning the relationship you want to induce with your users and your audience, questioning your own position as author. I brought you here some examples of the work that we did with some art centers that we published products and results on the Creative Commons or Free Art License. So you can see that's not just talk. I mean, we try to do it. And this, of course, obliged the museum and the institution to invite lawyers to discuss, can we take this seriously? Or how are we going to deal with that? Meanwhile, we have published always under the clear copyright thing. So, as I said, feminists, we have to have a critical position towards the author, but does he have to be at the cost of our name? So, do we have to let our work falling in the public domain? I mean, the public domain before Severin's coming to change it. No, we can also make it clear that we want, and we are conscious that it can be used, and we use, and we inject into the community. So I wanted to talk about how to license the content, and now I'm just a moment on free software. So for us, software is our habitat. We work on this, but software, 2 minutes. But the software is, of course, determining how you work. It's determining how you make access to your work, but also the aesthetics. I'm not criticizing PowerPoints by Microsoft, but the effects that you can have on this, on your presentation, are determined by what the plugins and all the characters that Microsoft provide you. So the tools of production of art content is determined also by the production of content and aesthetics is also determined by the technology you're using. So our concern was to be part of this lab, to be part of that technique. Not that we have to be programmers, but we have to be in contact with programmers. And we want to see what's inside the computer. So maybe you won't see the difference between the previous presentation and the second one, but the position, of course, and the use is determined by the free software that I'm using. So the idea is to enter in contact with our tools, in a way. So this I can show you also, but we are producing with free software videos, sounds, publications, free font, and so on and so forth. So it's not about, of course it's about ethics, of course it's about politics, but it's about entering dialogue with your tools, so it's the minimum you can ask. So I made a reference to Virginia Woolf that, of course, the work of fiction is depending on the conditions of work, on the conditions of the economy. And you, with free software, you can even mildly choose the community you're depending on. Of course, they are all not nice boys and so on, of course, but still you can at least be in contact with them. So I wanted to bring the idea of, but I won't have time, of media ecology. So it's about the fact that everything is in contact, connected. I use the term also machinic to say that, of course, the work you create is created with tool, is under copyright law, and so everything is in contact with everything. So we might engage So Freesoftware is not about Freesoftware or free license, not about free license, it's about also the connections and the relationship and the dynamics here in your own work community. So it's also about this idea about Freesoftware. It was not also, there was a question about originality and newness. Freesoftware, we're also conscious that we take something from history, that we don't destroy what before us. So this avant-garde thing with you to be new or different, no, we inscribe ourselves in a history. So there is this idea of recycling in a way. You, of course, pay homage to your history, so and your future history, because of course, if I put my work on the free art license, it's for the future. I cannot clear the past. That's I cannot use past work. Meanwhile, this is Rebecca is going to take care of us. The fans and we can use and we reuse. So this idea that what we can learn also from free software and free license is about distribution. But the distribution in the sense of you can distribute casts, different people in different worlds, also distribute knowledge and exchange. So Olaf, to finish, I wanted to say that just to show you one project that we're making is to build server, a feminist server done by women on free software. So it's about entering in contact with free software, but also about server. So meaning about question of privacy, access, control, because we want to be in contact with this power issue who is controlling the data. And of course, as feminists, when you put a website online, you know that you're entitled to attack and to react, and also as activists you can be also controlled, and sometimes anonymity can be also a good thing. So as you've seen, our encounter and practice of free software and free license made us enter in a world of contract. Meanwhile, public domain is not what we want to. We have to use legal term and computer code, and so I'm very far away from my practice with brushes and canvas, and that led me till here, I have to say. So my last remark, we have a lot of slashes fans around here. I would like to take back, because to be an artist, to be a free software user, to be a free software programmer is not a natural position. It's something you perform, something you take, something you want to use. So I suggest that we use this as vessels, processes, critique, action, and also it's not about contracts and legal terms all the time. You can go beyond. And of course, we all praise the fans for this, to go beyond contracts, even if they are, of course, really intertwined with the contractual issues. So I would like to suggest that we could be slash a fan of author. So, or slash a fan of art, that we can reclaim this, changing, modify and perform how we want to be an author, so how to be an artist. So I would like to suggest to let's give the author back a becoming, a devenir. Thank you.
These were three great presentations. I'm just going to make a few points that tie them together a little bit here and there and give just a couple of my own observations. One of the things, Catherine McKinnon didn't come up in this panel, she came up in the panel this morning, but I've immersed myself the last year or so in reading McKinnon, and I also, at Halbert's suggestion, reread Shulamith Firestone's Dialectic of Sex fairly recently, and some Simone de Beauvoir, which there's some real issues with it. You may know the mistranslations in her books not being in distribution, so that's been a bit of a challenge, but trying to come up to speed in that, because trying to figure out, not just for the IP stuff, but sort of generally, I guess, where I'm in my life, what the starting point should be for gender and identity, and I think all these papers touch on that slightly differently. Kevin's paper drove me back to the Haraway piece, the Cyborg Manifesto, and in fact, Ian hosted a conference in Ottawa not that long ago, where that was a real focal point for, Anita was on that panel too, as a matter of fact, a real focal point for some of the panelists, and they seem, they're feminists, not lawyers, except for, I think, Anita, me and Julie Cohn was on the panel as well, but their focus on the cyborg, they thought it was very, very important. That was my sense, that they really did, and I had to go back and reread it and go, okay, I don't get it, and then I read Kevin's paper again, and I still struggle with why that is seen so important. Like, that's a project for me that Kevin's helped me along. But I did want to point out, I think my biggest criticism, it's very rich, and I don't want to say it's very worthwhile to read. I just don't understand the starting place that other people understand for Haraway's manifesto. And I kind of read it, and I read it slightly differently each time, that she echoes Rawls a little bit in terms of the behind the veil starting place. In other words, you know, he says we're going to put ourselves behind the veil so we don't know the gender, the ability level, anything about the other person, and then we'll make this enlightened, informed decision about what the starting principles are. And I feel like a little bit, at least, Haraway is saying the same thing about the cyborg, because she's trying to move away from what she says is essentialism. And I wanted to read this a little piece where she writes about McKinnon, and she's quoting McKinnon from 87, which she's... McKinnon's evolved over time like all of us, but she picks a work from 87 and says, Catherine McKinnon's version of radical feminism is itself a caricature of the appropriating, incorporating, totalitizing tendencies of Western theories of identity grounding action. It is factually and politically wrong to assimilate all the diverse moments or conversations in recent women's politics named radical feminism to McKinnon's vision, but the teleological logic of her theory shows how an epistemology and ontology, including their negations, erase or police difference. Only one of the effects of McKinnon's theory is rewriting the history of the polymorphous field called radical feminism. The major effect is the production of a theory of experience of women's identity that is a kind of apocalypse for all revolutionary standpoints. That is, the totalitization built to this tale of radical feminists achieves its end, the unity of women, by enforcing the experience of and testimony to radical non-being. As for the Marxist socialist feminist consciousness, it's an achievement, not a natural fact, and McKinnon's theory eliminates some of the difficulties built to the humanist revolutionary subjects, but at the cost of radical reductionism. Now, what's she doing? She's really vociferously accusing McKinnon of essentialism, and how is she doing it? By essentializing McKinnon, right? Quite desperately. She's taking a whole rich body of writing by McKinnon and compressing it in a way which I find actually a bit unfair. And she goes on, she spends a fair amount of time criticizing McKinnon. I'm not here to tell you McKinnon is perfect or I agree with everything she has to say, but I do, I mean, to me the irony is really rich there, because when McKinnon is trying to achieve what she's trying to achieve, she certainly does do some essentializing. I think her more recent writings can see that and try to work with that. I think she tries to learn from some of the criticism, but I guess my larger point is that even when you want to criticize essentializing, you really can't get away from it. And I said at the beginning, you know, what is gender versus what is, are we asking the same thing when we say we're mapping gender, or are we mapping women? Right? I mean, right away, you could have a pretty long and heated conversation about whether that's the same question or a different question, I think. And that doesn't even get into race, which I'm going to punt and just stick on gender for the moment, but I think that makes it a more interesting conversation, too. But what does it mean to be a woman, right? You can have a pretty long conversation about that as well. Is it a matter of genitalia? Is it a matter of chromosomes? Is it a matter of lived experiences? All those things are very rich, interesting areas to talk about, but you know what? At a certain point, when you're a lawyer, right, you just got to take a definition and go with it if you're going to move forward, that you have to, at some point, for at least limited purposes, engage in some essentialism and some dualism, and in fact, at times, it can be very necessary and helpful to do that. I'm going to do that for 1 second now, based on some of the presentation, which is one of the things, as I get older, I think I notice more and more, it was probably already there, but I'm just more aware of it, is the expectation that women, for all of us, that we have to be ornamental, right? We have to look a certain way, we have to follow certain fashions. It's really hitting me hard recently when I try to buy clothes. Like, I just can't do it anymore. This has been sitting in my closet for like 15 years because I go to the store and there's absolutely nothing that looks good on me or is appealing to me at all. I know it's just because I'm too old, but it's very body-hugging, body-conscious, you know, clothing, and I just don't see myself going in to teach a class with my boobs like up here and sticking out with these low-cut shirts and saying, now take me seriously, I'm going to teach you about copyright law. It just, you know, you're expected to be toned, be thin, be in a certain way. I think you're punished quite vociferously if you don't succeed. But then here's the other thing. You never succeed, right? You're never good enough. You may have some, like, brief, shining moment of hotness, but eventually you get a little older, and it's all over. And then not only are you punished if you don't succeed, but you're even more punished if you don't try. Now, I have, like, long, stringy hair that I absolutely do nothing with, and I cannot tell you the amount of conversation conversation I've heard about, you know, how my life would just be vastly improved if I'd only do something with my hair. And I just like, I mean, but I know if I did something with my hair, it would just be onto my complexion or onto, you know, something else that I wasn't doing right. That I'm not, my hair, my nails, my clothes, my makeup, whatever. Okay, what's all this going? All this going is that I think that's one thing where I know I'm essentializing, but I think every person in the room, I think the men probably ruefully acknowledge it, but certainly the women, that something there, and I'm probably not expressing it right, is some sort of commonality of one's experience, but I can really only talk about that and draw you in any kind of productive way if I do some essentializing. So I guess that's my plug for that. I want to get to Peter made a point in a question that also came up through Ian's piece, Kevin's piece, and also the discussion of cyberfeminism, which is thinking about the morality of copyright. Again, I think this is something that we need to think about a little bit for the future when we ask questions about what it incentivizes, because if, as you know, I think came up in the morning's panel and this panel, it incentivizes bad things or the production of works that are harmful for oppressed groups, we have to really think about that, that the production of works and then the distribution of works, it may be that we're not incentivizing the production of the right works, and I think we have a far bigger problem with the distribution of works. Again, a De Beauvoir book is one good example of that. And just as a general matter, the kind of works that get mainstream media attention stuff, I think, you know, we got to figure out what copyright's role is in that, and if we can think about ways to sort of change that. Now, you know, Rebecca Toshner talked about the second model, having a burning passion to do something, and then you turn on the television and you watch these sitcoms that are like all alike, right, the sort of classic, and I'm just, you know, putting a comedian on this, the fat man, skinny woman sitcom, where they have kids. This is like exercise and self-mortification, where they just sit there and insult each other the whole time and insult their kids, and there's like endless numbers of those. Like, did anyone really have a burning passion to make any one of those? Like, I don't know where this comes from, and I think why am I so alienated from television? And you kind of do a little research. Okay, there's a Lifetime network, and you know, this, I think the reaction of the creative types is, well, you know, we make these shows for you broads, and you don't even watch them, so like, why do we bother? Or you don't patronize the advertisers, and the answer, of course, is that you're patronizing women, but like, where do you go with all that? I know copyright's not the only role in that, but in terms of just incentivizing creativity and what gets commercially distributed, the one thing about feminism, I mean, there's always the two questions of like, you know, what about the men and how feminism interacts with men? And there are certainly times when there's a zero-sum game, right? If there's a law school with 100 seats and men have all 100, you say no, 50 of them go to women, 50 men lost out, right? Men lost ground. You can say that's the right thing to do, etc., but men lost ground. But when you get to creativity, there's no upper limit, right? When I write a book, it doesn't stop anyone else from writing a book. So we have to figure out, why is it in the creativity, and like, are women not writing enough books? And I think that's partly, are they not getting enough credit for their creative efforts? Is it not getting distributed? And at the end, the only way to really track what's going on is going to require essentialism, to say these are women, and this is happening to, these are happening to a lot of women disproportionately to men. And again, that dualism raises its head. And again, I think as lawyers that we have to just say that's something that we're going to have to tolerate. I just wanted to finish by saying, I it's not that I don't think it's valuable, but the manifesto just doesn't, to me, reach the metaphor or sort of the situating of women that I think is useful for my thinking. I just want to recommend a substitute quite heavily. It's a book called Writing a Woman's Life. It's by Carolyn Heilbronn, who's a very brilliant English professor at Columbia. She was a notable feminist. There's a lot of inequitable time to go into why she's an interesting person, but she was, from soup to nuts, start to finish, everything about her, personally and professionally. It was very quite fascinating, including when she retired from Columbia with great animosity and anger toward the department and the way she'd been treated. And she was also a writer of mysteries under the name, pen name Amanda Cross. And I'm just going to read the back blurb on this, and then I want to read a quick excerpt, and then I'll stop. This says about this book, drawing the experiences of celebrated women from George Sand and Virginia Woolf to Dorothy Sayers and Adrienne Rich, Heilbronn examines the struggle these women's writers undertook when their drives made it impossible for them to follow the traditional male script for a woman's life. George Sand dressed as a man, George Eliot lived openly with a man married to another, indeed becoming a fallen woman or using a pseudonym, as Heilbronn herself has done. She's also the mystery author Amanda Cross, has freed many a woman to pursue the life she chose rather than the narrow role society handed her. So this, the pseudonymous other person is not a cyborg, but it is the overlaps a little bit with some of the cyborgian aspect. But one of the things that was interesting to me is at the same time Catherine MacKinnon was writing this book that Donna Haraway took such a strenuous issue with, was about the same time Carolyn Heilbronn was writing this book. So they're contemporaneous. It was copyrighted in 1988. And one of the things she does in this book, without having to be told by people like Donna Haraway, is trying to control for your essentialism. I think she did it intuitively. And I just want to read you one excerpt where she talks about, now she does essentialize too, and she doesn't call it that because that word really probably wasn't in use so much there, but she is talking about Audre Lorde, and she's talking about the poets of her generation, the things that she thinks they had in common. And she says, people, there are people I didn't include that I might have. She said, if Audre Lorde does not belong with the World War II generation, it is because she, her life and her work have focused on other patterns and influences. The work of black writers is not available because of chronology or the narrowness of canons to white women. The influence on her of African writers and narratives and her leap to outspokenness by which she appears compared to the women of my generation to have claimed identity sooner and more sharply without the same struggle. She announced that she was a black lesbian feminist warrior poet. Her struggle to become herself was different than the struggle of middle class women. She found African goddesses more empowering, perhaps, than a white woman poet would find goddesses from Greece or Christianity, but black woman writers have all written of those also. And then she gives some examples, and she says, by the time of the cancer journal, Lorde, writing of illness, women as victim and survivor, and the soul-saving grace of female friendship, speaks across race, national, or class boundaries for what is now her generation of women. Female boundaries has been given its first and most compelling text by black women writers of this generation. Toni Morrison has said, friendship between women is special, different, and has never been depicted as a major focus of a novel before Sula. It had not been depicted in autobiographical work as a major focus of a woman's life before the work of Audre Lorde and her generation. So I think it can be done, right? I think you can acknowledge essentialism and still really do a lot of room for our work. I can't recommend this enough, but the sad note is, of course, it's out of publication, so we have to buy it used out of Amazon.com, which kind of makes my point in the sad way, and I thank you very much.
Desire to sort of secure and expand the public domain, but then you run into this dualism. I wonder if you thought about it sort of from the other end, kind of for some reason. Maybe the expanding or securing or preserving the public domain is the wrong goal. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe you sort of start from that end and say, well, maybe I need to not think about the public domain, I need to think about it completely differently. That you can sort of work backwards and get to some degree of consistency, right? Because the thought struck me as you were talking about that. Maybe what we don't need is a regime that helps to keep thought out of the patent system or from being corporatized and put it into what Severin called this sort of contiguous area. Maybe what we need to do is think either more radically or in a more nuanced way about not dualizing that at all, and not trying to keep that free in some sense, because you know, Anupam Chandra and Madhavi Sundar sort of had written about a couple of the presentations Maureen alluded to. Putting things in the public domain isn't necessarily good either. And so, anyways, I just wonder what your reaction was to that, or if you thought about Severin's presentation, or if that helped you at all.
Two thoughts. That comment about the Sundar Chandra group. My understanding there is that, how I read some of that stuff, is that there's an instance in which particular formulations of putting things into the public domain ends up not being helpful, because oftentimes it's precisely the moment at which those who are traditionally disenfranchised would be likely to receive the rights, that those rights are shunted into the public domain, right? So there is a kind of a use of a dualistic structure there in a subordinating fashion, whereas as soon as someone's about to make a claim, oh, you take away the right to make claims in that particular circumstance, right? And that, I would say, is something that I had tried to formulate under this notion of regulatory impact of a dualism, right? You're actually allocating rights differently amongst different groups. And that would be something that I think would be very sensitive, I'd be very sensitive to and try to watch out for. I, as of yet, have been unable to figure out what the particular disprivileged group would be under the particular formulation that I'm offering. I'm not saying it doesn't exist, right? But in kinds of the scraping of the ground that I've done, I don't know how to get there. So that's I don't know what to do with that work in relation to the stuff I'm going to do.
That's one possibility. The other one, which I just sort of maybe I should have said more about in the essay, I kind of alluded to, and I think Sarah talked about, is you know sort of shunting certain resources in the public domain so they are available to those who are in power, right? You can think about it. I was worried about analogies to real property, right? But you can think about situations in real property where those who are in power say, well, we really don't want those mineral rights to be privatized, or we really don't want this rainforest to be privatized because we get free access to this stuff. And that actually is what's, all those negative externalities that we don't have to internalize are actually driving our ability to stay in power. And so that might be the flip side. It's not that you're denying it to otherwise disenfranchised groups that can get it, but maybe you're supporting a regime that relies on that free access to continue to remain in the social position that they're in. Mm-hmm. We're thinking about it.
Yeah, I
thought all the papers shared I thought all the papers shared a focus on the importance of connectivity in the network in various ways, particularly for women, whether it be women in their network, the personal network, the sense of a kind of genealogical. I mean, Virginia Woolf would tell you about the problem with women's writing is that they always had to reinvent the sentence, right? There was no sentence that could be inherited, so that in fact it was actually women's writing was inhibited by the lack of connection to a network, so that originality was actually the desire to have to be original all the time was actually the problem for women's writing because they did not have a canon or a kind of forebears drawn. And then in your presentation and the idea of self and other, right? That even that the self, a person, might be attached to a network in kind of really profitable ways. So I guess the question that I would sort of ask is to the extent to which copyright seems to always be applied to individuals, right? And individual works, efforts. It seems to me that all of your papers want to begin to think about how copyright might work on the network or what it would mean to start to see art in persons as attached to a network rather than as specific instances.
I'll just respond to that. One of the ways of making more clear my reading of Hardaway's cyborg in a very technological fashion, right, that we actually are cyborg, it would be a theory of distributed cognition, right? There are people out there who actually understand thought not as an entity that's occurring within someone's skull, but as an activity that is distributed not only between a person and a particular immediate or distant technological object, but also amongst people as well, right? So that in the paper I allude to the idea of distributed cognition as one of the potential shortfalls that the proposal that I'm putting forward has when you view the world from a cyborg perspective. Sorry.
Did you
want to
respond? Okay.
For me, by definition, copyright is networking because it's connected to the law. Has been decided by people and been applied by other people. So my idea is to say that then you have to put in copyright what you want as reaction to happen. So the fact to use free ad license, free software, make things work in a certain way. So you attach to your work or your software a possible an invitation to use. Because if you don't, there are some by default, there are some legal implications. And so, like, also every morning when I woke up, I have a small light on my computer that say, update. Because during the night, my night, some people were working on this. So free license make people work and make a community and connection. So yesterday, when I was reading, it's about goal and end, and the free software as attached with the free license, its own goal by the force freedom that say you can modify, but you have to put back to your fellow colleague and the community and attach to this how the, so it's not, as we say, viral, it's genealogical. So, I mean, law is network because it relates, it's how we can relate to each other. And this is the problem of copyleft, it's that it adds a new contract instead of talking to each other and negotiate the use, you ask the law to settle this for you. And this is problematic with copyleft because we count again, it's not that we don't love lawyers, we love each other, but it's again we are this, and I read some radical feminists, for example in Belgium on abortion, that they would ask a law to prohibit this or to a law to authorize instead of counting our common, to go back to the moralist and the moral, like we have a tendency to let the contract to decide the relationship with others. So.
So for Kevin, it's been a long time since I read the Cyberpunk Manifesto, but it seems like part of what you're doing is really just straight up Hegelian, right? It's there's mind, there's body, there's some sort of combination, and then synthesis. And so that raises the question of the end of history and whether or not we're getting there within the context of what you're talking about. But it seems for Haraway, the cyborg is a hybrid, right? And so it's the hybridity of the notion that's important. And it seems some of what you're doing is just moving the bar. It's like you move the bar this way and keep the dichotomy. And I might be misunderstanding your argument as well, most likely. So that we then just sort of move the bar into the mind or not into the mind, instead of thinking about it in terms of monstrosities and cyborgs, which I think is where she wants to push us, is to move, you sort of recognize that you're doing the binary thing and she's not. But maybe it's just better to think about it as a beginning project, what that means in terms of end of history and in terms of what you're doing. I don't know. Something to think about. And then Ian, I've never heard of the program you're talking about. It sounds really interesting. I want to learn more about it. But initially I was thinking it doesn't seem like such a bad idea for women who have been brutalized and are desperately trying to find a new life to be able to remake themselves. It's interesting that the government would help them do that. And so I guess at one level, I was curious about, and you mentioned that you do some of this sort of opportunities for identity as opposed to them as identity theft. And so where it's clear you're seeing some tensions there. But also it seems like the larger feminist critique, and it seems like you're getting at the end of it, we're going to talk more about it, is the government should be creating the world in which women don't have to run away and hide, right? I mean, so how much of what's happening here and the sort of misappropriation or misappropriation of identity keeps us from thinking about how to rethink the world in a way where men aren't brutalizing their loved ones in order to make them go away. So those are some things I was thinking about with yours. And then, Laurent, I would love to know more about this feminist hardware and some of the ways in which you're thinking about these things on the ground. Early on, you talked about moving from a sole sense of authority or authorship to a more collective sense. It seems like that's embodied a form of feminism. And I'm really interested to think about, get interested to know more about how those things happen. And then finally, for Anne, we always look at copyright. I know we didn't discuss it, but anyway. We always look at copyright, as a sort of neutral frame in which everything goes. But are you really then kind of making a claim for some sort of quality control that would be part of the IP?
Okay, so I guess the first point is, yeah, I think the way you characterized my toing and froing was right, and that I think you got my intuitions right. I want to start with the idea that we're talking about a group of women who are in a particular context and circumstance, that I would obviously rather see more options than less. The question is whether the current offering is an option or a non-option. And what we're learning and what we're finding out about that is the resources are so insufficient that it actually, my concern is that there could be, to put it bluntly, more harm than good. But I've always been very sensitive and conscious of the idea of trying to advocate that there shouldn't be such programs, because how can I come in here and follow what might be somebody's last option, if it is an option? But I'm concerned about that. What I was trying to get to at the end was to do, I think, both of the things you mentioned, which is to first of all say that instead of trying to provide these kind of band-aid remedies, there's obviously a systemic set of issues that's not being addressed. And this program, I think some, you know, me and many of my other feminist colleagues would say, is very much a band-aid solution to the problem of violence against women. That if we were to attack this at a more systemic level, this wouldn't even really be any kind of a priority. It seems to me that in a time, at least in Canada, where the recent change in government had the effect of removing the important Committee on the Standing of Women altogether, just making it evaporate, et cetera, meant that we had to take some of these existing options a bit more seriously than putting the focus where it might otherwise be. But yes, I absolutely agree with you in terms of your sort of diagnosis of where the problem lies.
Thank you for the comment.
It's a long story, so I don't know if it's the time to say, but it's a long story, because again, it's like when you produce your artwork, it's part of a history network and under certain laws, so we enter this, and working with software media, you can, becoming a feminist, like you put glasses or you are suddenly not blind, and you see everything. So I can't work on computer and ask what's inside the computer, and who's it building the computer, by the way. When I send back the data, who's controlling the batteries and so on and so forth. So that's one thing. The other thing, what I can tell you about this feminist server, most of the time was time to consider time and space and vocabulary. Because, of course, when you say a server done by women, which women? Which women have free time to do free software? So it's really in the space and time when we can do this. So I took we worked inside a training center for women, so for years, and then we come with this idea, and then some organization gave us the hardware and so on. So it takes a long time, and we invite people to talk to us. And Céline came about the rights issue we have to deal with. So it's the service catalyzer of power relationship. It could be the law, could be the code, and could be also control on the batteries. And also, one of the questions would be responsible if the police ask for certain IDs and certain content. And we want to face this. So we want to be to face this unstable, that's why I use sometimes, which is unstable mixtures of, we want to confront power relationship, not to say, okay, we will be completely anonymous, or we will be community-based. No, we want to face the decisions and see if we can make it differently. So do it like story. So it was on the March 8th that Amaya, she's called Amaya, so was put on the rack. That's what you see, is this big bag. So it's on the rack, but now it's the work beginning. But it took us almost a year only to organize babysitting, cooking, also that it's everyone brings what she can do, so and then change, so the one organized and the one to can be the one to teach. So this only to organize the conditions of how we're going to learn together, it takes, it's not about hardware, it's really this kind of practices.
I'll go to the next question. I'll just say, I didn't mean to say recommend anything other than to say, when we talk about copyright morality, we ought to not be so afraid of binaries and dualism as long as we're doing it, or we kind of recognize that we're doing it. Go ahead.
Hello. My question is for Kevin, which specifically, when you were speaking about cyborgs, I started thinking about cyborgs in the very technological sense of the word. More specifically, my question is referenced the emergent technology centers of artificial intelligence and human machine learning. More specifically, today we have a program called Deep Blue, which was the first AI system to actually beat a human at chess. To go on, there's even more efforts in this area to create machines, software, algorithms that replicate human thought, which is more of a masculine quality, human emotions and speech, which are more feminine qualities, I would say, and then also human decision making and differential diagnosis. So along with that, my question would be, according to your research, is this type of human-like mental process a patentable subject matter, or should it be? is the whole discussion just the commodification or propertization of human thought and emotion?
That's a great question. And in part, it's I tried to frame this speech as a kind of self-doubting look over my own shoulder, in a sense, and you have articulated one reason why a very straight-up division between mental processes conducted within the organic brain perhaps should not be categorically separated from a lot of the information processing tasks that either occur entirely within machinic software programs or occur in some kind of back and forth, right, between the mind and the world. So I think to the extent you suggest that actually thought is something that extends beyond the brain, right, it's not purely an organic concern, and that we should be concerned about protecting thought at that level if we're concerned about thought, I think that's a great question. All I can say is that in the context of this presentation, it's a challenge that I raise, right? I say, okay, there's some, I actually didn't even discuss the purported strengths of my proposal. I kind of put on an odd presentation where you put forward a proposal and suggest some of its weaknesses, right? But I think that is very much one of them. The way in which I'd respond is that there is should be more than one set of limitations on what can be patentable. In a larger scheme, in doctrinal terms, I would understand something like this bar on the propertization of human thought to coexist with certain other kinds of doctrines that might grow out of what we understand today as the printed matter doctrine. It might protect things we think of as information, and it's possible that that doctrine would end up doing some of the work that you, I think, are concerned should happen. And that if we look at a combination of the doctrine I'm proposing in combination with other doctrines that also should exist, perhaps the radical dualism that's inherent in the first doctrine in the set that I'm advocating for actually wouldn't be present in the long run. But as an incremental advocate for change, I grab the proposals as they come up in bank before the Federal Circuit, right? But it's an interesting question.
If I can jump in for a moment, too, I know I didn't speak about this topic at all today, but I happen to, it's not that I just want to speak about anything. I teach two courses in my law faculty. One is called Building Better Humans, with a question mark, and the other is called The Laws of Robotics. And those two courses are meant to twin the two ends of the continuum of the set of issues that you raise, with the human-machine merger being somewhere in the middle. The only thing that jumped out at me as a comment on, I don't want to comment on the patentability, but I want to sort of say something that I find students in my class talking about all the time, which is to say that when we have our sort of legal analysis sort of hats on, that's the instant question that we want to jump to. But I would suggest there are several layers of analysis which should precede that question. I'm not suggesting that you weren't thinking about them. You were probably interested in the patent question because that's what the presentation was about. But I think there are some serious philosophical and moral questions that underpin that very issue in a way that I think your example actually really raises challenges for the mind-world distinction as you draw it. Because you know, I'm thinking of people like Kevin Warwick, who is a cyborg at Reading University in the UK, who really is trying to build these brain hybrids with the internet, and it really raises the question of which is the world and which is the mind. So I think you know, you're going to see those issues coming up in different ways in the next several decades, and I hope the first issue that's addressed isn't the patentability issue. I really do.
Christine?
If there are other questions, I'll let
Josh.
No, well, not Josh.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I have a question here. I just want to point out that I'm really
Christine,
thinking...
Christine, use the
mic. Sorry, Josh. I'm just fascinated by a lot of connections I'm finding between Kevin and Ian's papers. I think it's interesting that you're both concerned with property-non-property distinctions. Kevin's advocating for non-property, and you're advocating for property. And I think you're both interested... You're both troubled by the preclusion of a thought connection. And I think that's very clear in Kevin's paper, you know, why why should there be a property interest that precludes doctors from making a correlation in the math and health analysis? But I think this is also operable in your concern, Ian, where your connection of identifiers and identity, I mean, that is a thought process, right? That's a thought correlation. And I just want to echo Dan's comments for both of you, that I think Severin's paper offers so many really helpful guidelines to think through these dilemmas, instead of just advocating for property or advocating for not property, but thinking about what are the conditions that are operating to steer policymakers in one way or the other, right? For your problem, Kevin, what's the market relationship between this information, right? If there's not a patent on the discovery, it's a discovery, not an invention, how is this information going to be protected? There's going to be another mechanism for protection. It's never not property or property, right? Somebody has discovered the correlation between the deficiency and the home system, right? So how is it going to be otherwise protected? Because of the importance in the market, because somebody's recognized those importance in the market. And similarly for Ian, I'm thinking that, it's very interesting to me, this population that's being affected by this policy. You said that there are people who don't have debt, but these are women in troubled circumstances. You know, the harms that you are outlining here, there was, if I remember, there was family, they won't be able to associate with family, they won't be able to associate with previous credentials, they won't be able to associate with previous memberships. In this population, how do you articulate the harm that's caused to them without looking at market harms there? You know, you could see if this were men who were being, in your second identity theft, I think it's more easy to articulate what is the kind of market harm to them that they face. But for this population of women, they're somewhat privileged, but maybe not privileged enough to recognize that. Not really a question.
We need to stop so.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much.